Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Wednesday, May 15th meeting of the Senate Rules Committee. And I think that we will start in on our House bills, and we'll take them in order. So I'll begin by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2078A. And Lori, could you tell us about this bill?
I'd be happy to. Excuse me, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2078A requires lobbyists to receive money or other consideration for lobbying to register with the Oregon Government Ethics Commission within 10 business days of agreeing to provide lobbying services or after first appearing or working for a person whom lobbyist has not registered to represent. It clarifies biennial lobbyist registration expires December 31st of each odd-numbered year. Changes the grace period to allow for renewal of registration if lobbyist renews by January 31st of the following even-numbered year. Requires an entity comprised of more than one lobbyist to report expenditures for each lobbyist. And removes requirement that legislative assembly receive notification of violations of lobbying laws. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, there's no subsequent referral, and it moved off the House floor with a 58-0-2 excused.
Okay, thanks very much, Lori. We do not have anybody signed up to testify on this bill, but I do see Ron Burson from the Ethics Commission here. Are you here just to answer questions, or?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Great. Okay. So we do have a quorum, and I can, members, we're in a public hearing. Did anybody want to hear testimony?
What problem is this bill fixing?
Okay. Let's have Ron Burson come forward. And if you could please introduce yourself for the record, and I think that's a great question.
Yes, my name is Ron Burson, Executive Director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, and Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Starr. Actually, the bill addresses several deficiencies that were in the current statute. One of those was is that a lobbyist is required to register a new client within 3 business days of agreeing to provide services for that client. And with all the multinational clients that lobbyists are hired by, they were having a difficult time meeting that 3 days. And once it got past the 3 days, then that becomes an administrative task on our part to actually look at why they were behind on that. And so in agreement with the lobby, we have agreed to go to 10 days. The other thing that it fixed was is under current statute, all lobbyist registrations end on December 31st of the odd year. So December 31st of, say, 2013, they'll all end. Well, now with a February even-numbered year session, they actually had till 90 days, so to March 31st, to be able to register new clients. So they could actually register a new client after the session was over. And so this takes that data, moves it back to January 31st, so those clients will be registered before the February even-numbered session. So it kind of brings the lobby laws in line with the way the legislative sessions are now structured.
Yes, please go ahead.
So what's required of a lobbyist today if they get a client on Wednesday? They have to notify you by Friday. I mean, can they do that online? Do they have to fill out a form? Do they have to come to the office? Can they fax them? Tell me how that process works today.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Starr, unfortunately the process today is a manual process. It is by paper. They can fax it to us, but they have to actually get a form, get a signature on that form, and get it back into our office. On Friday, our budget this year actually does include funding for an electronic reporting system. So the agency has been trying to get this online for about the last 4 years, and it looks like our budget this year does include that electronic reporting system. So hopefully in the near future, we will have the ability to do this online and do it more instantaneously. But the project's just going to start in this next biennium.
Great. Thank you.
Great. Thanks a lot. Any other questions from committee members? Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Burson. And I will close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2078A. Senator Starr?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2078A. 2078A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2078A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. Do we have a volunteer to carry this bill?
I'll carry it.
Great. Thank you, Senator Starr. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2078A. And should we just go in order? Okay. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2560A. And Lori, would you like to tell us about this one?
Madam Chair, House Bill 2560A prohibits an agency required by law to appoint a rulemaking advisory committee from appointing an officer, employee, or agent of the agency to serve on the advisory committee. There's no revenue impact. There was a minimal fiscal impact issued. Those statements are on the dais before you. And it moved off the House floor with a 60-0 vote.
Great. Thanks, Lori. And we do have one person signed up to testify on this bill, and that's Matt Marquis. And it's a little early in the morning. I know Matt Marquis. And good morning. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Matt Marquis, representing Bristol-Myers Squibb today, testifying in support of House Bill 2560. As your staff pointed out, this bill will require state agencies that are required by law to appoint a rule advisory committee during the process of their administrative rulemaking to appoint public members and not themselves. The original bill was written a little broader than we had intended. We worked with several state agencies in the House on the language that you see before you in the A engrossed bill. And again, it's fairly narrow. It just says if a state agency is required to appoint a rule advisory committee, that they shouldn't appoint themselves and they should be appointing public members. I think the purpose of an advisory committee is to get input from other folks as opposed to themselves. As mentioned, the bill passed the House 60-0, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, do we have any questions? And the chair certainly appreciates the clarification because the bill is a little bit confusing if you just read
Absolutely.
The summary. So, yeah, I think it's clear that it doesn't prevent an agency from doing what they would be required by law to do. It just basically says they should be appointing an advisory committee that's representative of the stakeholders.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Great. Okay, thank you again for the clarification. And I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2560A. Senator Starr?
Chair, I move House Bill 2568 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2560A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none. So ordered. And do we have a volunteer to carry this?
Okay.
Oh, great. Okay, thank you, Senator Starr.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I try to avoid carrying because every time I'm carrying a bill, that happens to be when Peter wants me to preside, I go rushing around.
Yes. Okay.
Like
so
I did on Facebook yesterday.
Sure. Senator Starr will carry this bill on the floor, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2560A. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2739A. Lori, could you please tell us about this one?
Happy to. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2739A renames the card issued to voters upon registration or an update to registration to, quote, voter notification card, close quote, makes permissive requirement for county clerks to mail notification card to voters when precinct changes occur. It declares an emergency. It's effective on passage. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, no subsequent referral, and it moved off the House floor with a 58-0 vote with one excused and another excused for business of the House.
Great. Thanks, Lori, for that explanation. And we do have one person signed up to testify. That's Mike Eliason, if you'd like to come forward. Good morning. Welcome Good morning. To the Senate Rules Committee.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I'm Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. Today here representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks, speaking in support of House Bill 2739A. This bill started out in the House Rules Committee with a couple of different concepts in it. It was eventually pared down to one concept that, as you heard, passed unanimously on the House side. The change in the bill would simply no longer mandate that county clerks send voters new memorandum cards, which would be here renamed voter notification cards, when boundary changes are made as a result of redistricting. So it's essentially would come into play only once every 10 years. The reason for the change is simply that with vote by mail, there's no longer a need for voters to receive information on where they vote. They simply get the ballot for the races that they're eligible to vote on delivered to their house. Voter notification cards would still be mailed in the event of when folks register for the first time or when they update information, whether it's party affiliation, name change, address changes, and the like. But this simple change actually would save counties an estimated over $300,000 after each redistricting if they were no longer mandated to go through and mail these out to all folks with boundary changes. We urge your support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Questions? Yes, Senator Starr.
Thank you for your testimony. What's the purpose of renaming the voter registration card a voter notification card? And what is the purpose, what uses of that card, or what can that card be used for?
Sure. Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Starr, I actually do not know the reason why. I'm not sure that was a suggestion that we made. It may have been a legislative council suggestion just for clarity. It seems like it's a little bit more clear to say voter notification card rather than memorandum card. Memorandum card is more of a sort of generic name. As for the use of it, it's actually more of just a informational card for voters. They can't use that. It's not a registration card. It's not anything that can be used for anything. It's simply a piece of information that sort of confirms to the voter that they've made an address change and it's been received and changed in the system. But there's no real, to the best of my knowledge, no real significance to the actual voter notification card. I would defer, though, to Secretary of State's office if there's clarification.
I'd be interested in knowing, Madam Chair, what a voter notification card might be used for. Can it be used for ID? Can somebody present a voter notification card and as a substitute for some sort of ID?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Starr, it's my understanding they cannot, but I would be happy to make sure that's verified for you.
Okay, and Senator Starr, just to clarify what your question is, are you asking whether for the purposes of voting it can be used
or
for ID or for other ID?
I mean, well, we don't ID voters. I mean, they get it in the mail. So, it's not like going to the polling place where you show your driver's license and prove who you are and sign the poll book anymore. So I'm just trying to figure out why do we even need this anymore? Is it a relic of, you know, go to the polls kind of voting? I'm not sure what the purpose is.
So we can certainly have the elections commission testify to that process. I don't know that we have people in the room that could address a broader question about using it for other purposes.
Might be worth having.
Yeah. Sure.
Elections division.
Good morning, Senator Beyer.
Good morning.
Okay, any other questions for this witness? Thank you very much for your testimony. And I see that the Elections Division and Secretary of State's office are here. Would you like to come forward? Senator Beyer, we're in a public hearing on House Bill 2739.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Steve Trout, State Election Director. Be happy to try to clarify or answer any questions that you have regarding the voter notification card. It's really part of the security process during the registration process or during the registrations that new cards are sent to people to let them know that their information has been updated to make sure that there aren't any that somebody didn't go and send in a registration form with an incorrect address or anything. So it's a way to validate from the voter that their information actually has changed. And so we send those cards to make sure that the information is correct and that they really did intend to change their information, whether it was party address, changing their name. And so that's the purpose of the card.
So just to follow up, the card can't be used for identification purposes as far as you're concerned.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Starr, you know, we don't have any intention to have that that card be used for identification purposes, but what other agencies or individuals accept for whatever identification they may be looking at, you know, we don't have any control over what documents they would accept for those purposes, but we don't intend it to be used as establishing any identity or anything.
So just an additional follow-up. So, I mean, historically, for a period of time after I registered to vote, I had a voter registration card that I actually carried that had my name, my address, you know, what precinct I was in, what congressional district I was in, probably House and Senate district as well, all listed on that card. Does this card have that similar information on it?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Starr, I'd have to get someone from the counties here to say exactly what is on that card, but really it's the, I know for sure it has the name and the address, and depending on what other information, they have that precinct number that you are in on what's sent out from the counties. Again, this is a county mailing to let the voter know that their information has been updated.
So I'm sorry to beat a dead horse, Madam Chair, but I'm trying to get to the bottom of why it is we're changing this to a voter notification card, as opposed to, in the statute it says a memorandum, it doesn't even say voter registration card. So who's the impetus for changing this particular piece of the statute? It isn't the issue that the county clerks had, because they just didn't want to have to, you know, do the mailing after redistricting every time. So what's who is driving this particular change in the law? Is it something from the Secretary of State's office or somewhere else?
So, Madam Chair, Senator Starr, it is from the county clerks. They're the ones that came forward with the language change, and it matches up with the terminology that they use now and have been using for a number of years.
And Mr. Trout, not to interrupt you, but it looks like the county is also coming forward to correct their previous testimony, so that might be helpful.
I thought I felt eyes behind my back.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Starr. Yeah, it turns out that is correct. That is terminology that the counties sort of have commonly used for a long time. And so I stand corrected. That is a change that they suggested, just because it's the terminology they use and to them is more accurate than just a memorandum card.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, and I would agree. I mean, I don't think anybody would really know what a voter memorandum card is, and maybe nobody would know what a voter notification card is, but it's certainly clearer than memorandum. So, yeah. And Senator Byer, did you have a question for these folks?
I do, Madam. I haven't really thought much about this before, but Steve, in the era that we're in now with vote by mail, it almost strikes me that these cards are absolutely useless, and why are we even going to the cost of mailing them out? I don't need a card. I mean, if I'm registered, I get the thing directly in the mail. It used to be, and you know, when I was much younger, you used to have this. Sometimes, I don't remember ever having to have to show it, but at least told you where your voter's booth is. That's just information that's unnecessary anymore.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Byer, that purpose of the card doesn't exist anymore. As I testified a little earlier, the main reason for these cards is security of voter registration, to make sure that when someone sends in an update or changes the registration, that we're able to confirm with them through these postcards that yes, I as the voter did actually request this change and this is accurate information.
A lot of expense. I mean, each one of these cards you're sending out is about 50 cents now. Well, it's more than that. If you include the cost of putting it together, you probably got for each one of these a couple of bucks in effort that doesn't seem to have much purpose.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, go ahead, Senator Burdick, and I had a comment too.
Oh, why don't you comment first, because I'm in a different
subject. I was just going to comment that, you know, we are in a changing world, but we still have a lot of voters who I think do appreciate, and I'm one of them, having a piece of paper that shows the districts that they're in and if they've changed their registration. And so, you know, I suppose you could say everything is electronic and you can always get that information some other way and verify that whatever change you made went through. But I think for a lot of people still, it's reassuring that they see that it actually...
I have no idea whether I've got one or not, and if I do, where it is.
Senator Burdick.
One of the things I noticed here is that this is qualified ID to get a concealed handgun license for proving your county residency. Is there any kind of date or anything on these?
I knew it'd come back to guns.
Most of this bill has to do with this.
Do you have any objection, Senator Byers?
I don't think the relating clause says that. But.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, I honestly don't know. This came up in the House as well, why this was tied to those provisions of the concealed handgun are in this bill, other than that was one of the sections that was being addressed here. I don't think there's any, to my knowledge, there's no intent to have this card be used for any identification purposes with respect to a handgun or any other purpose.
Well, because it's used to establish county residency, and the reason... that I bring it up is because without any date on it, you know, the sheriff would have no reason to or no way of knowing whether this was, you know, the person actually lives in another county and had this old card. So there's no date on it or any time.
No, Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, there is a mailing date that's on those cards.
A mailing date?
Yes.
Okay.
And they do it by batch, you know, depending on how many, you know, they get during a different period based on the resources they have in the counties.
And Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Burdick, if I might add, that did come up in the House, similar questions, but the made sure the relating clause was fairly tight related to election procedures of county clerks. So some folks brought up some gun questions that we said was far out, probably outside the scope of this.
No, my concern is, you know, if it's going to be used for identification for getting a concealed handgun license, then there should be some way of checking whether it's up to date. In other words, if a person may, you know, for whatever reason, choose to get a concealed handgun license in a different county, maybe where they used to live, and that's not allowed under the law, and if they can use this as ID, they could do that, and that's not outside the scope of the law. It might call for an amendment saying a voter notification card issued within the last 2 years or something like that.
Senator Rosenbaum, Chair Burdick, yeah, we could certainly look into that if that's.
We could certainly get legislative counsel in here. I would wonder whether an amendment like that would actually fit within the relating clause of this bill, though.
Relating to elections.
Right. So, any other questions for these folks? I don't see any. So,
thanks.
Thank you very much. And... Okay, I will close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2739. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2739A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2739 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Motion carries. And Senator Byron, we've had active volunteers up until now. Would you
volunteer? Oh, sure.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Byron. We'll carry this bill, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2739A. And let's see. Still don't have paper.
We do not. I just checked, Madam Chair.
And 146. We could 145. Okay, so I think we'll go to opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 145. And Lori, could you please tell us about this?
Happy to, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 145 expands the definition of petition committee to include a combination of two or more individuals or person other than individual who receives a contribution or makes expenditure for purpose of supporting or opposing initiative referendum or recall petition. It removes liability of candidates' treasurer for default or violation that occurs in performance of certain duties, requires the Secretary of State to send notice of civil penalty for failure to file campaign finance statement only to candidate, removes the requirement for periodic examination and investigation of randomly selected campaign finance statements, removes the requirement to file statement of expenditure deficit, requires political committee or petition committee that expects neither aggregate contributions nor aggregate expenditures to exceed $3,500 to file certificate to that effect with Secretary of State, or removes the requirement that candidate file statement or affidavit for contributions from out-of-state political committees upon request, and it removes the requirement that certain corporations file report regarding shareholders. There is a dash to amendment. This was distributed last week, and the committee did not have time to look at the measure. I think I attached the dash to amendment, and I also had a hand in gross last week as well, because there are a number of technical changes. The dash two removes the language expanding the definition of petition committee. It restores the current language pertaining to political campaign or petition accounts. It restores the current language pertaining to certain requirements of organization and function of petition committees, and it makes some other technical changes to make the provisions match and numerical. If you do not have, I have two extra hand and gross. We can make more copies if you don't have
one. I have extras, too.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
Would you like one?
Does anyone else need that? Okay. So thank you, Lori, for the explanation and for all of the work hand and grossing, even though that seems to be an old-fashioned method. It's often a way to clarify what we're doing. So,
Madam Chair, I wanted to get on the record. I think I forgot to say there's no revenue impact, or there is a minimal fiscal impact. No statement was issued. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Great. Thank you very much, Lori. And we do have one person signed up to testify, and that's Steve Trout, if you'd like to come forward again.
Good morning again, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Steve Trout, State Election Director, and thank you for the opportunity to come and testify in support of the of Senate Bill 145, which is our campaign finance housekeeping bill to try to clean up things that we've noticed over the last cycle, and we're proposing to move forward with the Dash 2 amendments. Relating the provisions relating to petition committee so that we can work on that in the future and have enough time to do that correctly. So really high level, what this bill does is it removes treasurer liability for any violations and puts that squarely on the candidate. We've had situations where a candidate goes ahead and pays the penalty, but the treasurer doesn't want to wants to continue on with the contested case hearing, and so even though the penalty has been paid, we'll have a treasurer wanting to go forward and take us to hearing on that. And so this really just puts all of the responsibility on the candidate, and then they can work out with their treasurer how they want to handle things. It removes language that requires statewide and legislative candidate committees to report contributions received from January 1 until sine die of a session. With our move to 48-hour reporting, that's really not necessary because during the session you have 48-hour reporting. So that's just something that isn't relevant anymore. We want to increase the threshold for triggering the requirement to file campaign contribution and expenditures from $3,000 to $3,500. This is purely because of the increase in filing fees for voters' pamphlets. So we have a lot of judges and local candidates that don't spend any money other than their filing fees and their voters' pamphlet statements, and so we want them to be able to raise enough money and spend enough money to pay for those things without having to create a committee if that's the only fundraising or expenditures that they're going to make. It removes the requirement for spot checks of campaign finance transactions for discrepancies. We've only had three requests to do that, and it's not a very efficient process. And then it deletes provisions in ORS 260.045, 049, and 102 relating to out-of-state PACs and other activities that we've had no activity at all in the last 20 years, and so it's just an obsolete section as well. So those are the highlights. I'm happy to get into the weeds if, on any of these provisions if you'd like, and want to invite any questions.
Okay. We'll give members a moment here. This is what's known as dead air, I think, in the radio business.
So,
yes, go ahead, Senator Starr.
So I'm looking at ORS 260.045 relates to the out-of-state political committees. So you're saying that in the last 20 years, a political committee in Oregon hasn't received an out-of-state contribution from a political committee out of state? Or...
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, no. What I'm saying is there haven't been any filings under or any reportings under those sections. Almost all of those, if not all of those committees, are going to be federal PACs, and so they'll have to report there. And then anyone receiving money from those federal PACs will have to report it as a recipient of those funds. So that's something that's handled through federal campaign finance rules.
Okay, other questions? I guess I'll ask one while others may be still. So the change dealing with spot checks, this removes the spot check process altogether?
Madam Chair, yes.
And could you then just tell us, since spot checks were supposed to be a method of ensuring that reports were being filed and accurate documentation was being kept to back them up, what are the sort of checks and balances in the system that continue to provide that mechanism?
Sure, Madam Chair, thank you. And with the maturation of ORSTAR and our campaign finance online system, you know, we have, you know, much more checks, much more logic going on in the background of these different committees, of the different transactions, and so we're able to identify any discrepancies that are happening sooner rather than having to rely on the spot checks. Since we started performing spot checks, we've only had 3 requests to review documentation, and you know, the cost benefit to that, the research to all of that is way more intense than and costly and less efficient than actually using our system to be able to identify those same problems.
Madam Chair.
Yes, go ahead,
and,
Senator Burdick.
And your cost benefit doesn't take into account the cost of the campaigns for doing these, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, correct.
I'm glad to see the end of them, if there's a way to do it without them, because it's just, there was one person that we paid bills to that didn't provide check copies, and it just caused a major, nobody knew what to do with it. It took hours and hours and hours to resolve it.
Thank you, Senator Burdick. Other questions? Okay, looks like you've answered them all. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 145. Open a work session on Senate Bill 145. And members, we do now have all the paperwork. We had this -2 amendment previously, but did not have the fiscal and revenue impact. Senator Starr, did you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move the -2 amendments to the bill.
Thank you. Senator Starr has moved the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 145. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Any objection to the amendment? Motion carries. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move the bill as amended by the desk to amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 145 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. And looks like probably the chair. It's the chair's turn to volunteer to carry a bill, so I will carry this on the floor. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 145. Senator Beyer, you did come in after we had voted, I believe, on two bills. Would you like to have us reopen? Okay. Then I think, members, we are not. The one remaining bill, we still don't have the paperwork, and I don't think it arrived while we were here, so we'll have to carry that over to our next hearing. I will just mention, in terms of scheduling, that next week we will be changing our meeting time from our usual 8 a.m. morning time to afternoon 3 p.m. on Wednesday. So hopefully that will work with your schedules. I think we checked people's committee. We'll be meeting at 3 next Wednesday afternoon, which is a time slot that is open on everybody's schedule in terms of committee schedules. So obviously we'll hope that you can make that work.
Is that going to be a permanent change? Or just
not a permanent change. It's only for that day. So that's a week from today. And then
the following week.
Oh, we're also, the following week is when we have executive appointments, correct, in the morning?
And maybe the joint meeting.
Right. So then I believe that's the 29th. So 2 weeks from today, on May 29th, we do have our usual morning meeting. That is executive appointments, which is our final batch of executive appointments for this session. And then in the afternoon, we're proposing a joint meeting with the House Rules Committee that would be an informational meeting for the purposes of hearing some discussion on some election-related campaign finance reform bills. So that would be
something that we have. 22nd is going to be at 3?
22nd is at 3, and then the 29th would be two meetings, one at 8:30, I assume, and then the other at 3, a meeting jointly with the House Rules Committee. Okay, so that's our scheduling discussion, and if with nothing further to come before us today, we are adjourned.
Perfect.